Welcome to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast. My name is Cheryl.
And I'm June.
In part three of the Arvizo allegations, we'll continue covering the criminal trial of Michael Jackson and hear from the rest of the prosecution witnesses.
You can find all source material for this episode and reach out to us through our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com.
Voice actor Derek Black returns to help us present part three in our series on the Arvizos. In the last episode, you heard us present strong evidence by the defense that the Arvizo stories shouldn't be trusted. But the prosecution has about 80 more witnesses. Can the evidence from these witnesses overcome the damage from the Arvizo's own testimony? Here's what I was looking for in the remaining prosecution witnesses.
Evidence that this family was held against their will and that Jackson knew about it.
Evidence that Jackson had a unified band of employees and handlers protecting him.
Evidence of molestation or suspicious behavior by Jackson around Gavin Arvizo or any other child.
Evidence of Jackson giving Gavin or any other child alcohol.
And on the other side, I was looking for any evidence helpful to the defense. I've organized the prosecution's evidence theme by theme, and we'll start with the evidence that the Arvizos were held against their will and forced by threats to make the rebuttal video. We're also looking for any evidence that would place Michael Jackson in any of this captivity planning.
Ann Kite testifies as the prosecution's second witness. She was hired to help with Jackson's PR crisis after the Bashir documentary release. It appears the prosecution calls her because her testimony makes Jackson's associates look unsavory, and particularly because of one statement she made in her police interview.
Kite testifies that in a phone conversation with Jackson handler Mark Schaffel, he told her the Arvizos had left the ranch, and he was upset about it. In a conversation later that day, Kite says Schaffel told her the situation had been contained. The prosecution wants the jury to hear the word contained because it suggests support for their case that Jackson and his associates were keeping the Arvizos against their will.
However, Kite never suggested nor provided evidence that any of Jackson's associates were forcing the Arvizos to stay at Neverland or to do the interview. And the day that Schaffel told Kite that the situation was contained was February 13th. This date was in the middle of the Arvizos' five-day stay at her fiancé's house, away from Neverland. So Schaffel wasn't referring to the Arvizos themselves being physically contained. The rest of Kite's testimony is helpful to Jackson's defense, because she says Jackson played no part in the PR planning. She says he was out of the loop and not well served by the PR team who had their own agendas, and were not effectively working to combat the damage done to Jackson's reputation. While working for Jackson, Kite learned of evidence that these associates were embezzling Jackson's money, which we'll get to a bit later. After reading her full testimony, I was astonished that Kite was a prosecution witness, because her testimony so strongly helped the defense. Besides the testimony of Ann Kite, what other evidence of captivity does the prosecution present to the jury? Although there will be dozens of witnesses who testify that Janet Arvizo never mentioned being held against her will when they spoke to her during her Neverland stay, including her own attorney, there are two witnesses who say she did.
Laugh Factory owner Jamie Masada befriended the Arvizos through his comedy camps and helped them out with money and gifts over the years. Masada testifies that during the Arvizo stay at Neverland, Janet called Masada and said she and her kids were being held against her will. Masada says he told her to call the police. The fact that Masada didn't call the police himself after hearing Janet's claim of captivity indicates that he questioned its validity.
Also discrediting is the fact that when Masada refers Janet Arvizo to lawyer William Dickerman, right in the middle of their stay at Neverland, he and Janet both testify that it's for the specific purpose of getting Gavin's photos out of the media, no other purpose. To me, it's irreparably damaging to the claim of captivity that when Janet meets this lawyer the day after the rebuttal interview, away from Neverland, she says nothing about being held captive or threatened.
The other prosecution witness who says Janet called with claims of captivity is Louise Palenker, a comedian who helped Jamie Masada with his comedy camps and also befriended the Arvizo family through her work there. Palenker helped out the family with money and gifts, and the Arvizo family called her often. But she confirms in her testimony that when she got that call from Janet about being held captive, Palenker called her own lawyer afterwards, not the police. A few months before she testified at trial, Palenker is interviewed by police. In this interview, she told police that Janet had hostage syndrome that made her feel trapped, and also said she thought Janet was bipolar and needed to see a psychologist.
Another witness the prosecution hoped would add weight to their conspiracy charge is Rudy Provencio, who worked for one of Jackson's companies at the time and was close to Jackson associate Mark Schaffel. Provencio says he was told by Schaffel that the Arvizos had escaped from Neverland. But on cross-examination, we find out the term escape did not have the nefarious meaning the prosecution tried to suggest, because the Arvizos' method of escape was to call a Jackson employee who would take them wherever they wanted to go. Sometimes it was shopping, sometimes to Janet's boyfriend's house. So there's no case to be made of being held against their will if they can just call and ask to leave, as they did multiple times during their stay. Furthermore, Provencio was not worried enough to call police or tell anyone else, and he maintained his friendship with Schaffel.
Neverland security guard Brian Barron is brought forward to testify about a written directive stating that the Arvizo kids weren't allowed off property during their stay. Barron confirms this directive, but says it meant that the kids were not allowed off property without permission from the ranch manager. He explains that it was the policy of the ranch as a safety measure for kids. A later defense witness and Neverland safety officer will confirm that it was a ranch safety policy to make sure kids do not leave without adult supervision, and that because the Arvizo boys were known to secretly drive off in ranch vehicles, they had to be extra vigilant about them.
The remaining evidence put forward to support the claims of captivity and conspiracy were phone, travel, and financial records.
The phone records fail to show anything, except that Jackson's associates made a lot of calls, which you would expect in a PR team managing a crisis. The prosecution argues that the travel records suggest that Jackson's team was planning to take the Arvizos to Miami for the press conference. But even if they were, it doesn't have a lot of meaning when it can be logically interpreted as a legal PR move.
The prosecution puts forward a forensic accountant who argues that Jackson was in critical financial straits. Some legal analysts thought it was an outrageous move to expose all of Jackson's personal finances to the public. The prosecution argues that his financial situation was part of the motive to kidnap the Arvizos. The courtroom was shown all of Jackson's financial records. However, Mesereau, in his cross-examination, was able to demonstrate that Jackson could have solved his financial problems in various ways easily.
The prosecution calls a bank manager who approved cashing $1.5 million by Jackson associate Mark Schaffel in April 2003. However, Jackson was not tied to the signing or cashing out of the money. The prosecution failed to tie this to the alleged conspiracy in any way, especially since this transaction happened after the Arvizos' alleged final escape.
So that was the most significant evidence I found for the prosecution's conspiracy charge and the Arvizos' claims of captivity. Next, I wanted to find out if there was evidence to support the claim that Jackson had a loyal team of associates protecting and hiding his abuse. But the testimony from the prosecution witnesses pointed in a different direction. The predominant theme from these witnesses is that Jackson's handlers were prioritizing their own financial gain when making PR decisions, not protecting Jackson's reputation. The following is a summary of some of this testimony about Jackson's associates.
Ann Kite was the PR manager who testified that Jackson's associates did not have his best interest in mind with their PR planning. Kite learned of evidence from another recent hire, attorney David LeGrand, that one of Jackson's handlers, Ron Conitzer, managed to secure the power of attorney from Jackson and used that power to embezzle almost $1 million. Kite's interactions with the Jackson team led her to believe that they had a financial interest in letting the tabloids skewer Jackson unchecked and only directing their efforts on selling the rebuttal footage that would be lucrative to them.
Kite was fired after 6 days of work after expressing concern to some associates about how they were handling things. Ann Kite, a prosecution witness, will turn out to benefit Jackson, as her testimony shows how Jackson was in the dark about his own PR team and provides further evidence of Jackson's gullibility. Here's her quote about these Jackson associates.
I couldn't discuss anything with anyone because they all had different agendas.
Many other prosecution witnesses will echo Kite's testimony that these associates were opportunists, taking advantage of Jackson and not serving his best interests.
Kiki Fournier was a housekeeper who worked at Neverland for over 10 years and also observed that specifically Mark Chaffel was an opportunist. Jackson's ex-wife Debbie Rowe said she didn't trust any of Jackson's associates, and she specifically called Mark Chaffel a con man, who she said was planning to later sue Jackson, which he does.
Our final witness on the issue of Jackson's handlers is the testimony from Neverland house manager Dwayne Swingler. While he ended up being a pointless witness for the prosecution, I found parts of Swingler's testimony telling on the subject of Jackson's hiring practices.
Swingler testifies that his cousin called him in April 2003 because they needed someone to whistle on a Jackson music track. Swingler says he ended up hanging out with Jackson and his kids for a few days at the studio, and on his last day, a security guard told him that Jackson liked him, and he ended up with a job as Neverland's house manager. Swingler only worked for 5 weeks, but then he talks to the tabloid News of the World about writing a book on his experience at Neverland.
On the stand at Jackson's trial, Mesereau questions Swingler about why he was speaking to the tabloid News of the World. Here's Swingler's response.
Because I was interested in maybe possibly writing down some information to cash in on something, like everybody else was.
To me, this quote is reflective of the mood after the allegations became public. The handlers around Michael Jackson were trying to cash in. The mood wasn't let's band around Jackson to protect him. Swingler's testimony offers an example of how lax Jackson was in his hiring process. The house manager is a position that puts him in close daily contact with Jackson, overseeing his house staff and private quarters. In case after case, I saw how Jackson used his intuitive feel of a person when hiring them, showing a trusting Jackson who isn't necessarily interested in checking references, but hires based on how well he likes someone and connects personally to them. Jackson's often spontaneous, intuitive process for hiring people worked well for him in his creative endeavors, but it didn't always serve him well in hiring his managers. Jackson's hiring practices don't match with a person who has something to hide and would want staff who would be fanatically loyal to him. If he's guilty and wants to protect his secret, it's an extremely risky approach to hiring. And it's another of many examples of how Jackson doesn't pay off or intimidate employees when they're fired. We're next going to look at the evidence to support Gavin Arvizo's claims of molestation.
Besides the Arvizos' own testimony, the prosecution will also use witnesses who allege they saw different boys molested by Jackson. These are called prior bad acts witnesses. The prosecution argues that this evidence will demonstrate a propensity to commit sex abuse.
The judge allows testimony concerning 5 boys that the prosecution wants the jury to believe were molested by Jackson: Brett Barnes, Macaulay Culkin, Wade Robson, Jordan Chandler, and Jason Francia. But incredibly, the only one on the list who testifies for the prosecution is Jason Francia. Jordan Chandler refused to cooperate, and the other 3 are defense witnesses, vouching for Jackson's innocence.
We'll review these prior bad acts witnesses, starting with Jason Francia.
Jason Francia, who's the son of former Neverland maid Blanca Francia, is 24 at the time of the trial. As we discussed in the Chandler episodes, Francia received settlement money from Michael Jackson, so his financial interests should be considered in weighing his testimony.
Jason's claims are that Jackson tickled and touched his genitals 3 times, 2 of those times in a 1-room apartment where his mother worked as Jackson's maid, and the 3rd incident was alleged to have taken place in the Neverland arcade.
The biggest problem with Francia's testimony is that his confession that Jackson molested him only came after repeated coercive questioning by police. Police ridiculed Jackson in front of Jason Francia. They used foul language and gave false stories about other boys being molested by Jackson. When Francia said nothing happened except innocent tickling, they pressured him to remember more.
In response to this police pressure, Francia, who was 13 at the time, replies to the detectives,
"If I don't remember, I don't remember."
Francia will eventually change his story, saying Jackson did tickle him inappropriately. And when later asked a question about the incidents that he doesn't have an answer to, he tells the detectives,
"Well, I'll have to work on that."
Francia has a second police interview a few months after the first. In this interview, Francia says to investigators,
"They made me come out with a lot more stuff I didn't want to say. They kept pushing. I wanted to get up and hit them in the head."
On the stand at Jackson's trial in 2005, Francia testifies to Mesereau that he said things in those police interviews because,
"I was trying to figure out how to get out of there."
Because his confession would be considered unreliable according to current standards for interviewing children. "I was wary about Jason Francia's allegations from the beginning, and his testimony at trial only made me more skeptical."
Before Francia claimed anything inappropriate happened, he told police detectives that Jackson offered to give him $20 for every book he read because he didn't like to read, and offered to pay him if he got all A's at school to help motivate him. But once Francia changed his story to say he was touched inappropriately, the money for book story changes. Francia testifies at trial that Jackson would give him $100 after every tickling incident and put it down his pants.
This kind of story evolution reminds me of a quote from the PBS Frontline special Tabloid Truth about the Chandler allegations. A reporter was quoted as saying all they needed for a tabloid story was a shred of truth and they could run with it. In this case, Francia started with innocent playful tickling and $20 for books read. But after police suggestion and pressure, Jason ends up with a story about touching his privates and $100 hush money stuffed down his pants. This claim of hush money strikes me as very odd, because Francia says that Jackson never actually says anything to him. He just gives Francia, as a 7-year-old, $100, and presumes he knows that it's to keep quiet. Another odd part of the story is that he says these three incidents are years apart from each other. The first one when he was 7, the next one 1.5 years later, and the next one 2 years after that. He makes no reports about Jackson trying to reach out to him in the intervening years to make sure he would keep quiet. No escalation or trying to get closer, and we get no details about how often Francia sees Jackson in between these incidents. In the first two incidents took place in a small one-room apartment, where his mother was cleaning and could walk over at any time. It all sounds very risky for someone who, if the prosecution narrative is to be believed, has gotten away with abusing many boys because of his stealthy tactics. Reading Francia's testimony reminded me of Jordan Chandler and his psychiatrist interview, because they both were at the ready to add in details that weren't asked, such as Francia adding how hard his mom worked and how he needed years of therapy to get over these incidents. Francia had to be admonished to only answer the questions asked. Francia also reminded me of Gavin Arvizo in his confidence during cross-examination, challenging Mesereau frequently by saying, "You already asked me that," or "I answered that already." The judge told him that he doesn't get to object to the questioning, that he needs to leave the objections to the prosecution. Francia was also similar to the Arvizos in his legally convenient selective memory on the witness stand. Even though he admits to reviewing all of his prior testimony and interviews before testifying at trial, he almost reflexively answers "I don't know" to any legal question. He doesn't even seem to pause and try to recollect. Francia immediately says he doesn't remember attending a meeting with his mother and prosecutors 4 months prior to trial. When he's told there's a record of his being there, he suddenly recalls it, but then can't remember why he told prosecutors that he did not want to be recorded during the meeting. Francia claims he wasn't sure if his former lawyer was still representing him at the meeting, and then he's reminded that he specifically asked that lawyer to be there. Francia claims to the jury that he has no idea if criminal charges were filed based on his allegations. They weren't. And claimed he did not know if he signed a settlement with Jackson. He did. Francia's selective memory regarding legal matters left a bad impression on the jury. The jury foreman, Paul Rodriguez, spoke to Nancy Grace after the trial about Jason Francia's credibility.
"Well, we got a little problem with that because he had no idea where some of his money came from, and he didn't want to talk to his mother."
So would it be safe to say you did not believe him?
"Yes, we had a hard time believing him." The second prior bad acts witness is Jason Francia's mother, Blanca Francia. Because she worked as Jackson's personal housekeeper only until 1991, she never saw Gavin Arvizo or Jordan Chandler. At issue on the stand in 2005 is her inconsistent story of Wade Robson in the shower with Jackson in December of 1989.
As we discussed in the Chandler episodes, Blanca Francia has told her story numerous times in sworn testimony. In some versions of her story, she says that she can see two bodies in the shower and hear two voices. And in other versions, she says she can only see Jackson and only hears his voice. Notably, in all versions of her story, Francia does nothing and says nothing to anyone, and she continued to bring her son to Neverland after this alleged shower incident.
Blanca Francia was paid $20,000 for her interview on Hard Copy with Diane Diamond, which Francia said was more than her annual salary. Blanca was also one of the Neverland employees who connected with Victor Gutierrez before coming out with any allegations.
The prosecution gets Francia to confirm on the stand that she saw two figures through the smoky glass of the shower and two pairs of underwear on the floor. However, on cross-examination, Mesereau questions Francia about her deposition in December 1993, when she clearly testified that she did not see Robson in the shower.
Do you remember in your deposition saying you had never seen Mr. Jackson touch anyone improperly?
Yeah.
Okay. And in that deposition, you told the truth, right?
As I recalled at the time, yeah.
You told the truth at the time, right?
As I remember it, yes.
And you were under oath, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you said that you had never seen Michael Jackson touch anyone in a sexual way, right?
Yeah.
Francia also confirms her 1994 deposition, when she said she only saw one figure and one voice in the shower. Francia tells Mesereau on the stand that yes, this was the truth. She only saw one figure and one voice. The third prior bad acts witness is Ralph Chacon, who worked as a Neverland security guard from 1991 to 1994.
Aphrodite Jones observes in her book Conspiracy that as a witness, Chacon was defensive, angry, and obviously had an axe to grind.
Chacon's allegations are that he saw Jackson molest Jordan Chandler in the showers by the pool and another time in the rec room at Neverland. However, after witnessing this, he says nothing to anyone, not even his buddy Abdul, also on duty, with whom he says he carpools.
The defense is able to destroy Chacon's credibility through multiple angles. His stories about witnessing molestation came a year or so later, only when there was money offered for such stories from the police and from the tabloids. Chacon owed Jackson money at the time of this trial and had stolen $25,000 worth of goods from him. Chacon's prior lawsuit against Jackson was found in court to have been fraudulent. He has a proven history of lying under oath and is angry over the wage and status changes that occurred when the new Neverland guards were hired.
The fourth prior bad acts witness is Jackson's former personal maid, Adrian McManus, who we discussed in the Chandler allegations. In her sworn deposition back in 1993, McManus strongly defends Jackson and says she never saw inappropriate behavior towards children. There's even testimony from friends not related to Neverland that McManus told them Jackson was innocent and that the Chandler's sex abuse claims were a bunch of bull.
McManus changed her story a year later after she met with Victor Gutierrez and joined Ralph Chacon and others in a lawsuit against Jackson, which was judged to be fraudulent. She also comes to Jackson's trial owing him money. When she takes the stand for the prosecution in 2005, McManus testifies that she witnessed Jackson kissing boys and inappropriately touching them at Neverland. She identifies these boys as Macaulay Culkin and Brett Barnes, who have both denied any abuse, and Jordan Chandler. In all these incidents, she describes how she walked from one room into another or looked down the stairs to witness the alleged abuse.
McManus says after witnessing the abuse, she just walked off into another room. She says she didn't say anything because she was threatened by Jackson, but she doesn't explain what she meant. She also doesn't explain why, if she were so threatened, that she felt perfectly free to go to the tabloids and file a lawsuit. Another Neverland employee testified that McManus asked her to lie and say McManus was sexually harassed by the guards at Neverland. Her lawsuit was found to have been fraudulent, with no evidence to back up her claims of being threatened, and she was found to have stolen $35,000 worth of goods from Jackson. She admits on the stand that she sold stories to the tabloids about things she knew nothing about. It's also revealed that McManus and her husband were found to have defrauded her nephew and niece out of their money and were court-ordered to pay them $35,000.
Another prior bad acts witness is Philip Lamarck. Lamarck and his wife worked for Jackson in the kitchen at Neverland for about 10 months, 2 years before the Chandler allegations. Mesereau brings up a lawsuit Lamarck filed against Jackson, claiming his Neverland supervisor didn't pay them for overtime and didn't give them the references they requested.
Lamarck testifies that on one occasion in 1991, he was called to deliver French fries to Jackson in the arcade at Neverland. He says he witnessed Jackson put his hand into Macaulay Culkin's pants. Lamarck claims that he was so shocked by the sight that he almost dropped his French fries, but he never reports anything to the authorities or anyone else.
Macaulay Culkin, in his later testimony, discredits this story by Lamarck, saying he was never molested by Jackson, and Mesereau brings forward a police interview in which Lamarck states that he couldn't really tell what Jackson was doing with his hand.
On direct examination, Lamarck testifies that he was approached by many tabloids and considered selling his story, but decided not to because it was against his principles, and instead went to the authorities. However, we learn about a recorded conversation between Lamarck and tabloid broker Paul Baresi from August 1993, weeks before his police interview. Lamarck is recorded trying to increase the price up to $500,000 from the original $100,000 that they had been discussing.
In PBS's Frontline documentary, Tabloid Truth, Paul Baresi says that Lamarck came to him trying to sell their story, and says the only reason Lamarck talked to authorities is because Baresi sent police the tape of their conversation. So this prosecution witness is caught lying on the stand. Lamarck tells the jury that he wouldn't sell stories and hadn't negotiated with the tabloids because it's against his principles, and instead he went to authorities. But Lamarck's recorded conversation reveals him negotiating hundreds of thousands of dollars to a tabloid broker. And he only talked to the authorities because Baresi sent this tape to police.
Former PR manager Bob Jones testifies as a prior bad acts witness because of an email he sent about seeing Jackson lick the head of Jordan Chandler. When he sent this email about seeing Jackson lick Jordan's head, Jones was in the middle of writing a salacious book about Jackson. Bob Jones says to the press that the reason he wrote the book is because he was pissed off and broke. Jones was fired by Randy Jackson after the Arvizo allegations broke. Randy was cleaning out staff who were self-promoting and ineffective, and Bob Jones was a casualty of this effort.
The book called The Man Behind the Mask was co-written with Stacy Brown, who I would describe as an unscrupulous journalist because of how he sensationalizes stories. The Bob Jones and Stacy Brown book is tawdry and reads like a tabloid. In it, Jackson is attacked for his vitiligo.
Michael Jackson, beneath the bleached skin that has made him a grotesque caricature of a female alien, was black, too. He was also the weirdest and most inexplicable of racists.
The book contains one inaccuracy after another, especially regarding the Chandler allegations and settlement, and uses witnesses like Blanca Francia without citing any of her credibility issues. Bob Jones admits on the stand that there was pressure to sensationalize his stories by co-author Stacy Brown. The prosecution asks Jones about his book.
Is this a factual manuscript, or is it a fictional manuscript?
It is factual, to a degree.
To what degree is it factual?
It's to a degree, because my co-writer also has included things that I didn't approve of.
Most importantly, Bob Jones testifies that he does not recall any headlicking of Chandler. He also confirms that he made a statement to police just a month before his trial testimony that he never observed any headlicking. Jones may have gotten the idea for the headlicking story from the grand jury testimony that was leaked to the public, which included the headlicking allegations of Gavin. This leak happened in January 2005, which was a time frame that Jones was working on his book revisions. Bob Jones is another prosecution witness that ends up helping the defense. Jones's testimony shows that Jackson doesn't try to pay off former employees for their silence, and it shows how anger by a disgruntled employee gets channeled into writing a salacious account for money that Jones himself can't even stand behind. The final prior bad acts witness is Jordan Chandler's mother, June Chandler. Because I presented much of her testimony in our series on the Chandler allegations, I'll only comment here on what we didn't cover. One thing to remember is that June Chandler was at risk of losing custody of Jordan if she didn't side with her ex-husband in the lawsuit against Jackson. She was also at risk of being sued by Evan, and she received a $1 million settlement, which she used to buy a new home in an upscale LA neighborhood, so her account should be viewed with these financial interests in mind.
June testifies that she hasn't talked to her son in 11 years, ever since the 1993 allegations. You'll remember after the settlement, Jordan Chandler legally emancipated from both parents. It's worth considering that June Chandler may hold a grudge against Jackson for losing Jordan, whether or not Jackson was guilty of abuse.
While most of the prosecution witnesses turn out to actually strengthen Jackson's defense, I found June Chandler the one prosecution witness who helped both sides equally.
June Chandler supports the prosecution's case with her details of the amount of time Jackson and Jordan spent together, which is material we've already covered. On the stand at trial in 2005, Sneddon has June recount two times when Jackson became emotional because he was feeling like June didn't trust him. She describes how later in the relationship, Jordan wants to spend more time with Jackson and less time with the family. She testifies that she regrets putting her trust in him.
So while June Chandler's testimony helps the prosecution with their stories of their close friendship, in other respects, she helps the defense.
June Chandler has always been consistent in her police interviews that she was never suspicious nor ever saw any signs of molestation, and she was with Jordan at all times Jackson was around, and Jordan was never alone with Jackson at their house. June Chandler says she never suspected anything going on between her son and Jackson and thought they had a great friendship. She describes Jackson as a regular guy, nothing like the superstar image, very down to earth. She testifies that Jackson has to be treated like a regular person. This goes against the prosecution narrative that Jackson put families under a spell with his star power.
In her book Conspiracy, Aphrodite Jones observes that DA Tom Sneddon was red-faced and steaming that his star witness was not going as planned. Jones also writes that June Chandler came off as a gold digger, and points out how June Chandler has conveniently selective memories in her testimony, similar to Jason Francia, such as not remembering the simplest details about her lawsuit against Jackson.
And that wraps up the prior bad acts evidence. Although their testimony fed the media's hunger for stories about sex, the cross-examination evidence demonstrated that the words of these witnesses should not be trusted. Here's the headline from a New York Times article in April 2005 that sums up the problems with these prior bad acts witnesses.
Duplicity, greed, and dubious characters on parade at Jackson trial.
Besides these prior bad acts witnesses, the other evidence put forward to support the Arvizos' claims of molestation are fingerprint and DNA evidence. While the prosecution tried to overwhelm the jury by the number of experts, including 9 different fingerprint experts, the evidence actually helps the defense.
Detective Spinner testifies that out of the many adult magazines that were removed and tested from Neverland, there were only 12 matches for Jackson, 8 matches for Gavin, and 1 match for Star. There is one magazine that had both Jackson's and Gavin's prints, but they were on different pages. The experts couldn't test for when the fingerprints were left, since prints on paper can last for decades. The prints also don't prove Jackson showed the magazines to Gavin and Star because the boys admittedly went into Jackson's suite when he wasn't there and were known to rifle through the belongings of others, as testified to by numerous other witnesses.
Lieutenant Jeff Klopakis testifies that the Arvizos' DNA, body fluids, hair fibers, and fingerprints were not found anywhere on Jackson's mattress, bedding, or any furniture linked to the bed, which is important considering the accusations of masturbation to ejaculation in this bed. The prosecution takes any and all opportunities to parade Jackson's large collection of pornographic magazines in front of the jury. According to Aphrodite Jones, they project image after image up on a big screen in the courtroom, apparently as part of their strategy to debase Jackson's character. Although the prosecution says the magazines were used to show to Gavin before abusing him, because these are all magazines targeted to heterosexual men, such as Playboy, Hustler, and Penthouse, It helps the defense case that Jackson had a sexual interest in women.
The prosecution will put a magnifying glass on about 25 art books found in the raid, many with nudity, but only a handful with anything sexual. All of it carries little weight because these books are legal and artistic, and you can buy them anywhere. And just because Jackson had a book in his possession, there's no way to know how he used these books, especially since some were obvious gifts and we aren't presented with any fingerprint evidence on them. One example is a book by James Bidgood, an avant-garde, well-regarded photographer who was planning to photograph the Jackson family. This book, which was gifted to Jackson by Bidgood himself, includes photographs taken throughout his career and is widely available from many online booksellers.
Michael Jackson was passionate about art photography and a voracious reader, and was known to buy up entire collections at secondhand bookstores without knowing the contents. The defense continues to make the point that the amount of sexually explicit material is a tiny fraction of the 10,000 books in Jackson's collection. We have a link on our website to all of the books and magazines that the prosecution brought into evidence. Next, we'll look at whether or not there was any evidence outside of the Arvizos' stories that Jackson gave alcohol to Gavin. The answer is a pretty clear-cut no. Instead, the prosecution witnesses support the defense argument that Jackson did not give any alcohol to children.
Flight attendant Cynthia Bell testifies that on the flight from Miami to L.A., which took about 5 hours, Michael Jackson was her lead passenger, and therefore she kept her eyes on him the whole flight so she could tend to his needs. Bell says she never saw any head licking or giving Gavin alcohol. She personally served Gavin orange soda and said she did not think Gavin was at all intoxicated.
Bell testifies that Jackson's kids were around him for the entire flight, Jackson often playing with them. And although Gavin had a seat next to Jackson, he moved around during the flight, sitting elsewhere to talk to his sister and Marie Cassio. Bell said Dr. Farshan sat directly across from Jackson because they had dining seating, so seats were facing each other. She says the two nannies on the flight could see Jackson at all times. The defense wants to show how it was only the Arvizos who reported that Jackson licked Gavin's head and gave him alcohol, even though there were numerous other people who could see Jackson at all times who didn't see these things.
None of the other Neverland employees who testified at trial said they saw Jackson giving alcohol to Gavin or any other child. The closest the prosecution gets is with the testimony of house manager Jesus Salas, that he once served wine to Jackson and sodas to a group of kids that included, but wasn't limited to, the Arvizos, sometime during their stay at Neverland.
So that's our summary of the prosecution's case against Michael Jackson. Their witnesses not only unveiled the weakness of Sneddon's case, but they actively helped the defense. For our remaining trial coverage in this episode, we'll look at more testimony by the prosecution's own witnesses that supported the defense. First, we'll look at some of the examples of police bias and violations of Jackson's due process that were revealed in the prosecution's case.
The lead investigator assigned to the Arvizo case, Sergeant Roble, testifies that he obtained a search and arrest warrant on Neverland without conducting any other interviews outside of the Arvizo family and Dr. Katz. Sergeant Roble states that this was due to the high-profile nature of the case and his concern that conducting further interviews would have compromised his investigation.
This makes sense because if Jackson is guilty and tipped off about the investigation, he could potentially hide evidence. But police still could have investigated the Arvizos' past without compromising the investigation, which would have revealed their prior fraud and undercut the Arvizos' credibility. So while I understand why a search warrant would be granted without first interviewing Neverland employees and other witnesses, I don't understand the justification of the arrest warrant, which was issued at the same time as the search warrant. This was an arrest warrant based almost entirely on the Arvizos' interviews with police and Dr. Katz. That you can so irreparably damage someone's reputation through arresting him based on uninvestigated allegations is unjust. The evidence used to support the statement of probable cause was all either misleading or false, and reveals that this investigation from the beginning was biased and had an agenda. There's also the issue of Sergeant Roble's suggestive questioning in his initial interviews with the Arvizo kids, where he takes on the role of a validator rather than a neutral interviewer.
In his first interview with Evelyn Arvizo, he makes it clear to her that he believes Jackson is guilty, and he's there to help them win their case. Here's a sampling of Roble's statements to Evelyn from that first interview.
They're the ones that have done wrong, not you. I don't care how much money they have, who he is. He is wrong in what he's done. You guys are the victims.
He also tells her,
we're going to try our best to make this case work.
Jackson's lawyer, Robert Sanger, asked Sergeant Roble on the stand if, from the very beginning, he had made a concerted effort to make the Arvizo case work. Roble testifies,
yep, I did.
This affirmation by Roble came back to me many times throughout this case. The police and DA Tom Snedden were clearly giving it everything they had to try and make the Arvizo case work. Through the questioning of witness Lieutenant Zealous, we hear damaging evidence against Tom Snedden and Gavin Arvizo. Lieutenant Zealous is asked about a prior interview in which Tom Snedden effectively told Gavin how he should explain the nice things they all said in the rebuttal video. Here's their exchange, starting with Snedden asking Gavin a question.
The acts of molestation, had they already begun by the time you did this video?
I think so.
So in your mind, one of the things you're thinking is, they've done this video that they want you guys to do that if you ever told them the truth about being molested, that nobody would believe you.
And Gavin confirms Snedden's narrative of what happened. So in this version of the story, confirmed by Snedden and Gavin in their January 2004 meeting, Jackson's associates had to force the Arvizos to do this interview and say nice things because the sex abuse already happened. But Gavin's story at trial is that no abuse had happened before the interviews. So how could Jackson's people be forcing him to deny what hasn't yet happened? The Arvizos failed to reconcile these contradictions in their story. And finally, on the subject of police process, there's the problematic issue that fingerprint testing was done on Jackson's adult magazines after they were brought to the grand jury proceedings. And there's evidence that Gavin handled them without gloves. There's no notation in the court transcripts that Gavin put on gloves when handling some of the magazines, as was noted when other witnesses were handling evidence. If he didn't put on protective gloves, it would have added Gavin's fingerprints to magazines after the fact and rendered the fingerprint findings meaningless.
Also bolstering the defense is the revelation of financial conflicts of interest with some of the prosecution witnesses.
The defense brings forward evidence that Dr. Stanley Katz had been wanting to be on a celebrity case as publicity for his new TV show, which suggests he may have financial motivation to move the Jackson case forward. Dr. Katz was the psychologist who first heard Gavin's claims, and it was partly based on his evaluation that police moved the case forward.
The defense reveals to the jury the potential huge payout to the Arvizos for their participation in the criminal trial.
The Arvizos civil attorney Larry Feldman testifies on cross-examination that if a conviction occurred in Jackson's trial, the Arvizos could use anything they wished from the criminal case into a civil suit to claim monetary damages. He confirms that it would be an easy win. Mesereau is shaping his questions to Feldman to suggest that the Arvizos are using taxpayer money for a criminal trial to cut the cost of a lengthy civil suit should Jackson get convicted.
Because the law changed after the Chandler case, the Arvizos had no option but to go through with the criminal trial before they could pursue a civil lawsuit for monetary compensation. Finally, on the issue of money motives, we have William Dickerman's testimony for the prosecution, Janet Arvizo's first civil lawyer. Dickerman says their first meeting was February 21st, the day after the rebuttal video was shot. Janet's fiancé, Jay Jackson, testified that he asked for money before the rebuttal interview, but was turned down by Jackson's team. The timing of visiting a civil attorney a day after Janet realizes there will be no money for the rebuttal video is important to keep in mind.
The defense case was also strengthened by the many prosecution witnesses who contradicted the statements of the Arvizos.
Neverland employees Jesus Salas, Kiki Fournier, and Brian Barron testify that they saw Janet Arvizo having dinners in the main house with others, even sleeping with her kids in the theater and walking around outside, which contradicts her own testimony that she stayed completely confined to her room.
There were numerous witnesses who contradicted Davalin's claim that she never had any alcohol except when Jackson gave it to her at Neverland. The flight attendant Cynthia Bell said on the flight from Miami before arriving at Neverland, Davalin presented what she later discovered was a fake ID. So she served Davalin alcohol on the flight. Other guests saw Davalin with alcohol at Neverland without Jackson around.
Gavin and Star were seen sleeping in Jackson's downstairs suite when Jackson was not at Neverland, contradicting the Arvizos' sworn testimony that they were never sleeping in Jackson's suite without him.
There were many witnesses, such as house manager Jesus Salas, who say that Janet complained about being kept away from Jackson, versus her own testimony that she was kept away from her kids.
Janet Arvizo said she didn't call 911 at Neverland because she was unable to do so. However, many witnesses, including her own fiancé, say Janet called them from Neverland during her stay. And the prosecution's own phone expert testifies that there was nothing preventing outgoing calls in any of the guest units.
Jackson's videographer, Hamid Moslahi, was fired by Jackson's team after the Arvizo's rebuttal interview and then sued Jackson for unpaid work. Yet Moslahi testified that there was no coaching and no script for the rebuttal. He said Janet's only hesitation to do the interview came from a worry about more press attention.
Jay Jackson testifies that he was unaware that Gavin had any problems at school, which contradicts the testimony of Gavin's school counselor, who says that Jay Jackson himself was present at the meetings he had with Janet to discuss Gavin's unruly behavior.
Our final witness on the subject of contradictory testimony is Neverland employee Angel Vivanco. Vivanco and Davalin were alleged to have a romantic relationship during the Arvizo's stay at the ranch. According to Vivanco, Davalin told him that Janet was planning something big regarding Michael Jackson, and that Davalin didn't want to participate in that plan. Although his testimony about Davalin's statements is not admitted due to its hearsay nature, Vivanco's account corroborates that of Arvizo friend Carol Lemire, who gave a statement that Davalin told her that Janet was planning to blackmail Jackson before their first Neverland visit.
The defense brought forward evidence of perjury in the prosecution's last witness, Rudy Provencio. 2 weeks before his testimony, Provencio claimed he just found some notes he wrote down 2 years ago when the Bashir scandal hit. However, these notes, which were dated, were shown to have included impossible events about the Arvizos based on the known dates of the Bashir documentary release.
Also helping the defense is the prosecution evidence that shows how the Arvizos were using celebrities for money and gifts and not being honest with them about what the money was to be used for.
Palenker testifies that she loaned the family $20,000 for home renovations needed for Gavin when he was ill unsolicited, but found out the money was used instead for other personal items, such as a big screen TV. She says she was asked for money often by David Arvizo, Gavin's father, and the prosecution uses her testimony to try and bolster their narrative that it was the father, and not Janet, behind the grifting schemes. However, on cross-examination, Mezzaro brings up how even though David collected the checks from Palenker, the checks were deposited into Janet's mother's bank account, which is where Janet was also depositing other checks in an apparent attempt to hide them. And David did not have the ability to write checks from Janet's mother's account. Laugh Factory owner Jamie Masada says he held two fundraisers and a blood drive for Gavin and paid for the Arvizo's rent a few times.
He testifies that after talking with Janet and her fiancé Jay on the phone, he paid for judo classes for Gavin. Jay Jackson told him they didn't have enough money for the classes, so Masada offered to pay for them.
Masada says he didn't know that Janet's fiancé, Major Jay Jackson, was earning a good salary from the U.S. Army because he had the impression that they were all poor. He also testifies that he bought Davalin a watch because she said she needed one.
Masada says he gave them money whenever they asked him. They would say, "I need money for food, for gas," and you give them whatever you have in your pocket. He says when Janet brought up sending the kids to private school after the documentary, he offered to pay for them.
Comedian George Lopez testifies that he also gave the Arvizo family money and gifts and came to realize that the fundraisers weren't about Gavin's health, but about money. Lopez's wife also testifies and says that her dealings were with David Arvizo, not Janet, in terms of asking for money. She did find it odd that Janet was never at the hospital while her son was apparently dying. It was always the father caring for him. The defense notes that at the same time Gavin was in the hospital, Janet Arvizo was busy litigating the JCPenney case and using Gavin's illness to her benefit. Ann Lopez says that Gavin would tell her about the gifts Michael Jackson gave them in a way to suggest that she and George weren't giving them enough.
Gavin's indirect requests for gifts or money is a tactic his mother Janet uses repeatedly, according to the testimony of many other witnesses, for both the prosecution and defense. Louise Palenker's prior police interview reveals Janet Arvizo's influence on her kids. Palenker said she thought Gavin was being coached by Janet to ask her for a computer, and he and Star were coached to deceptively say they hadn't gotten any Christmas gifts. Regarding Janet's money schemes involving the children, Palenker is quoted in her police interviews as follows.
Janet always put Gavin up to it, and he had to do what she told him to do.
She is also quoted as saying to police that David and Janet Arvizo are teaching their kids to lie. After filming the rebuttal interview, videographer Hamid Moslihi testifies that he ended up loaning Janet Arvizo $2,000 because she indicated to him that she needed money and said she was struggling financially, showing another account of Janet's indirect solicitation for money.
Janet's fiancé Jay Jackson testifies that he went back and forth about money for a tabloid story after the Bashir documentary aired, and he turned down the $15,000 that was the final offer. He also admits that he directly asked Jackson assistant Frank Cassio for money for the Arvizos' participation in the rebuttal video. He says he heard how much they were going to make from the rebuttal video and thought it only fair that the Arvizos should get something out of it. Here's what Jay says he basically told Frank.
You're making millions out of this. What is this family going to get? They already made nothing out of the Bashir documentary, so it's only fair.
Jay Jackson says Frank would not offer any money, but did say they could help the kids with their college education and a house. But Jay Jackson says he was only interested in a monetary compensation.
Jay Jackson says he allowed Janet to become a signatory on his bank account, and he endorsed and deposited her welfare checks into his bank account, because he claims he was not aware that she actually had many other bank accounts and was not aware of the JCPenney settlement money until it came out in the news.
One thing that stands out about Jay Jackson's testimony is the similarity of seeing him be the one to ask for money directly, just like Janet's ex-husband David Arvizo was said to be the front man asking for money. Once I researched all the evidence presented at trial, I came to view Janet as the puppeteer of her financial scams, directing her husbands and kids in her roles for them, while she hid behind the scenes and made more indirect pleas for money. And the last aspect of prosecution evidence we're going to cover in this episode is the testimony that shows Michael Jackson to be naive and vulnerable to opportunistic players. This goes to the defense theme that Jackson was not the predator himself, but the victim of predatory people around him, who took advantage of his gullibility. It also plays to the larger innocence theme of how such a naive and trusting person is incongruous with a scheming, manipulative child molester who has to always be vigilant and suspicious of anyone and everyone because of the possibility of his explosive secret getting out.
We've already discussed how Jackson was naive by trusting his associates to handle his affairs who were stealing behind his back. We heard about his naive hiring practices, intuitively hiring people, such as Dwayne Swingler, rather than doing a thorough background check. Through publicist Bob Jones, we can see Jackson being too trusting when he doesn't have him sign a confidentiality agreement. But the clearest and most public example of Jackson's gullibility is his decision to have Martin Bashir film a documentary about him.
Bashir was actually the first witness, but we're going to end our discussion of the prosecution's case by highlighting how Bashir manipulated Michael Jackson in the making of his documentary.
Before questioning Bashir, the prosecution plays his documentary, Living with Michael Jackson, for the jury. A number of people who are close to Jackson, such as Lisa Marie Presley and Frank Cassio, have commented that he's clearly under the influence of painkillers in some of the scenes, and say the film does not give an accurate portrayal of him.
Jurors would later remark about Bashir's obvious luring of Jackson into his trap, and journalist Aphrodite Jones observes that it was like taking candy from a baby for Bashir due to Jackson's gullibility.
In one outdoor scene at Neverland, Jackson comments that climbing trees is his favorite thing to do. Bashir scoffs at this and insinuates that Jackson's answer about climbing trees is odd, and with subtle ridicule in his voice asks, "Don't you prefer making love or performing instead of climbing trees?" Jackson looks puzzled, like he's truly trying to understand Bashir's question. And his guileless expression reminds me of the gullibility of a young child. He clearly can't see how Bashir is leading him into his narrative of Jackson as strange and dangerous. Jackson answers him sincerely that of course nothing could compare to performing, which is his life's work, but says his favorite pastimes are climbing trees and water balloon fights.
In his voiceover narration, Bashir expresses astonishment that Michael Jackson would be hanging out with kids at Neverland after what happened with the Chandler allegations, and we see footage of kids having fun with Jackson at the ranch. However, we find out from defense evidence that it was Bashir himself who wrote a letter to Jackson's assistant asking them to invite kids to Neverland for filming.
So Bashir asked Jackson's team to invite kids to Neverland for a positive scene of innocent play, and then turns around and says in his film that it was Michael who brought these kids to Neverland, and isn't that disturbing?
Bashir wrongly reports in his documentary that Jackson and Gavin remained close friends after their phone calls during his 2-month cancer treatment.
We know through Gavin's own testimony that Jackson severed the contact between them right after that first Neverland visit. But Bashir misleads the audience into thinking they've had a close relationship over the past couple of years, and isn't that disturbing? When Bashir asked Jackson repeated questions about plastic surgery, again Jackson looks befuddled, and even comments that he's surprised Bashir is asking him these questions, because he thought Bashir was a serious journalist. And although Jackson was suspicious of how the interview with Gavin was set up, having them hold hands with Gavin's head on his shoulder, Jackson still doesn't see how Bashir is playing him.
The jury will later be shown Jackson's rebuttal footage that he sold to Fox. This is the footage that Bashir cut from his own film. The jury sees Bashir effusively praising Jackson for caring about neglected children, and Bashir wonders aloud why the media only shows negative things about the pop icon. He says how wonderful it is to watch Jackson lift children's spirits. Bashir says it was a privilege and an education just to watch Jackson being a dad.
Bashir is making these wonderful comments about Jackson at the end of the documentary, after he's seen Jackson for many months, in what he himself says is unfiltered and open access to his life, nothing off limits. These praising comments by Bashir at the end of the documentary are cut and not included in his film.
What remains in the documentary is Bashir's narrative that Jackson's behavior around children is disturbing, highlighted by the carefully constructed scene between Jackson and Gavin.
Jackson should have been suspicious of where Bashir was leading him, but he continued to trust him throughout the filming and was completely shocked when the documentary aired. To grant full access, no conditions, and no intermediaries while negotiating with Bashir is quite telling of Jackson's too innocent nature. Jackson had no one do a background search on Bashir to check his journalistic integrity. If he had, he would have found out that Bashir was officially reprimanded 2 years prior for misleading a film subject by falsely promising him information in exchange for an interview. And an independent inquiry commissioned by the BBC concluded in May 2021 that Bashir deceived Princess Diana by using fake documents and false pretenses to secure the famous 1995 interview with her. If Jackson was really a successful serial molester and always trying to protect his secret life of abusing children, I'd expect him to be extremely cautious and suspicious about who he lets into his world, and not likely to fall for the obvious journalistic trickery by Bashir. But Jackson was quick to trust Bashir, believing his promises. Bashir's manipulation of Michael Jackson is one of the most publicly transparent examples of how people took advantage of his trusting nature, to use him for their own self-promotion. And that concludes our summary of the prosecution's criminal case against Michael Jackson. Tom Snedden and the other district attorneys were willing to throw anything and everything into the courtroom, hoping that something would stick in the minds of the jurors. And consider that this is a highly regarded, competent prosecution team, spending unprecedented amounts of money, time, and effort on this case, with many search warrants executed, detectives sent all over the globe, and many experts hired. Jackson's attorney, Tom Mesereau, in several interviews, explains how when presenting any case, you want to have your strongest witnesses in the first and last positions on the stand, He says, start strong and finish strong. Well, the prosecution started with Martin Bashir, who the jury came to view as self-serving and manipulative. And they ended with Rudy Provencio, who the defense found convincing evidence of perjury. Their witness list is bookended by deceit, which I see as emblematic of the injustice that underlies this whole case. Because the prosecution had no substantive evidence, the only way they could pursue this case was to blindly engage with dirty players who had a vested interest in a guilty narrative. Without one defense witness brought to the stand, you can already see the accuser and his family caught making false statements under oath. And you can see the family history of fraud and grift and how this accusation against Michael Jackson fits right into their playbook.
In the next episode, we'll present our final chapter on the Arvizo allegations, covering the defense witnesses, the trial aftermath, and the media response to the verdict.
We'd like to thank the following websites for their collection and analysis of the evidence in the Arvizo case: The Michael Jackson Allegations, Vindicating Michael, and Reflections on the Dance.
You can find all sources for this episode on our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com. And you can reach out to us on our website or Twitter at @Case4Innocence. Thank you for listening to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast.